I'm Ellen Schaefer. I'm the co-director of the Equal Health Network. Based in San Francisco, I have degrees and other stuff that I do, but I think I'll start by telling you that I have been a union organizer, as Martha reports that she has been as well, or at least reports how union organizers should work, and I completely agree that one must bargain from a position of strength. And I think the question is how we could have built that strength in the last 2 years and how we build that strength going forward. I have also written a proposal for socialized medicine, and nothing would have made me happier than to see a strong movement for single payer and for socialized medicine over the last 2 years. I think it's a different question and something maybe we'll have a chance to talk about as to what we all did that worked or did not work during this last campaign. I would suggest to you we didn't seem to be successful in our efforts to get to being on the verge of the goal that I think we all agree on. I want to talk about, I want to make the mouse work. I don't have anything to disclose, which APHA asks us to do. And the title of my talk was that health reform was in fact basically not bad in terms of social justice, and to suggest that it can move us forward on the road towards a better healthcare system, and to suggest, as I'm going to do at the tippy end of my talk, that what we really need to do is look at some of the other economic dislocations that are coming down upon us, towards which we need much better solutions than we're getting, and need to link those solutions with our prescriptions for healthcare reform. I want to point out also that there are some handouts. You don't need to get up now, but there are some summaries of the what we afford, some people call PPACA, and those of us who are more favorably inclined affordably call, affectionately call the Affordable Care Act. There are some summaries on the back in the back of the room, and you may want to take a look at one. So I do want to spend a little time talking about the bill, the law itself, because I feel like there's a lot of misinformation about it. Hopefully we can stimulate some discussion. I was thinking as I was starting this talk, the whole time I was in college, which was not for very long, people were talking about the perfect synthesis of Freud and Marx. They didn't finish that before I graduated. I'm not sure I'm going to finish and make the perfect synthesis between healthcare reform and socialist revolution in our economic system, but I'm going to do my best to tell you what I can. So let's see where we go. So how come the new law is controversial? Right-wing opponents know that they can't muster the clout to repeal the law, but they certainly intend to focus on undermining it, objecting to a statist government takeover. The public is divided. Some are uncertain. Some negate the gains, consider it a corporate takeover. Some are actually experiencing the benefits and support it. There are unfinished issues, as we've heard, and I'll say some more about that, that continue to be controversial. The social divisions around abortion and coverage for immigrants and the role of the government, which we saw played out to the extent that we talked about single payer during the last couple of years and also around the public option. I want to suggest that the road ahead to social justice includes looking at jobs, income inequality, peace, LGBTQ rights, the administration's policies on don't ask, don't tell. I think all of these other issues are ones that we need to consider and address as we think about how to address healthcare reform. Simple prescription. So I want to talk about what the Affordable Care Act does, the conflicting critiques, very briefly, the political and economic contest, and the wins and losses for ongoing mobilization. Indeed, we continue to have a crisis in access, cost, and quality. We know that people are suffering, and this is one slide because I think we're all pretty familiar with the cruel and inhuman and horrifying system that we have put up with to date. The fact that we spend $2.5 trillion a year, more than any other country on earth, almost $8,000 a person, don't cover everybody, that people do die from being uninsured in this country. People become bankrupt because of their medical expenses even when they have health insurance, and our outcomes are execrable. The Patient Protection Act does expand coverage and access, takes steps to improve quality, and offers consumer protections. I want to suggest that it opens some policy space and takes some steps towards the kinds of single-payer system that we would like to see. It expands coverage. It requires financing by the government. Because of that, individuals and employers will create incentives for cost controls, and there are changes to quality in the delivery system that will guide cost control while protecting benefits, in no way as effectively as what a single-payer system will do, but these are changes that we must both argue about and make if we're going to succeed in transforming our society and our healthcare system. Very briefly, the Affordable Care Act phases in benefits. There are a number of public health grant programs, and I think people have been talking about those. For the next couple of years, there are consumer protections, improvements in affordability and quality, and I'll talk briefly about what some of the ones are that go into effect first. Major coverage expansions through in 2014 through the health insurance exchanges and an expansion of Medicaid. As of 2020, the Medicare donut hole will be gone, and I'll spell that correctly next time. The changes in coverage now are access to a new high-risk pool for people with pre-existing conditions who can't get coverage. Young adults to the age of 26 are able to stay on their parents' insurance plans. In terms of affordability, there are rebates starting this year to people who hit the Medicare donut hole. Small business tax credits of up to 35% for businesses that buy insurance. There are new powers to the state and federal governments to reject unreasonable premium increases and a program to reduce the cost of early retiree coverage. Health insurance plans will be required to spend at least 80 to 85%, depending on how large the insurance companies are, 80 to 85% of the premium on health care. There's a policy debate, of course, as to how that's going to be defined, whether wellness programs and volunteering for the Boy Scouts, as I heard from someone today, is going to count as a medical expense. This is a debate we can engage in. Preventive care will no longer, there will be no copays and deductibles for preventive care. Certainly the fact that the HRSA hasn't been able to figure out whether contraception is in fact preventive and should be covered is disturbing and something, again, we can contest. That is something that will be decided over the next year. We hope to advocate for that timeline to speed up. Increased funding for community clinics, more money for primary care and public health. Discrimination against children with pre-existing conditions is prohibited. Plans can no longer drop you from coverage once you have it because you've got breast cancer now and you didn't tell them you had acne when you were 15. There is a ban on lifetime limits on the dollar amount of your coverage. 4 years from now, there will be annual limits will be phased out. I mentioned Medicaid will be expanded to cover people up to 133% of poverty. Right now, as most of you know, it's conditional. You have to have other conditions in addition to being low income. That will change. Health insurance exchanges will be open to provide a marketplace for insurance for individuals and small business employees. There will be premium subsidies up to 400% of the poverty level and limits on benefits and on out-of-pocket spending. There's a five-year waiting period for documented immigrants, and undocumented immigrants will not be covered, another issue we have to continue to work on. The insurance exchanges will apply to members of Congress. Members of Congress and their staff will have to buy insurance through the exchanges. And again, as we've heard, there is not a public option. Premiums on the exchange could be considered affordable. Certainly, they could be better, and the out-of-pocket limits could be better than they are. But this is, but it is certainly more affordable than it is now. And for people who are at risk of losing everything they own when they get sick, I would suggest that this is an improvement. Single-payer bills, of course, also require people to pay for them. They have the advantage of controlling costs much better in the long term. But the kinds of premium payroll taxes that we've seen in single-payer bills are not necessarily, don't come up with numbers much different from these. I'm just going to zip through these a little bit more quickly. This just shows the difference between the percent of income that you'd spend, which is the red line on top, depending on your income, the percent that you'd spend for an individual insurance plan versus what you'll spend under the Affordable Care Act. This is how the law is paid for. I'm sorry. This shows that, yes, indeed, there still will be some people with who are uninsured, but fewer. And the people will be moving into Medicaid and possibly insurance plans. This looks at the funding, which is includes progressive taxation, as well as needed cuts to the Medicare Advantage plan. This is the national deficit without health reform. And I think you know which line is which. There are, yes, significant limits. Reproductive health, there's a retreat from the current law. Contraception is not yet considered a preventive service. As I mentioned, abortion care is excluded from coverage through the exchanges and the high-risk pools. The undocumented are excluded, which doesn't work and is bad policy and not tolerable. Affordability could be better. There is the possibility of state options for innovative approaches, including single payer. So how come this is so hard right now? First of all, it's always been hard. All of these presidents have tried to reform our healthcare system. Johnson succeeded in passing Medicare and Medicaid. President Clinton, the S-CHIP program. I want to suggest that, sorry, these might be a little out of order, that what we've been experiencing for the last 30 years, however, is a slightly different situation where our economic and social policies are the equivalent of structural adjustment for the United States. We've seen deregulation, privatization of public services, and constraints on public interest organizations, which folks in the global health movement sometimes call civil society. As a result of these regressive policies, we've seen a growth in, Cornel West certainly said all this much better, a growth in income inequalities, which has exploded in the last 30 years, whereas income growth was distributed roughly equally in an earlier period, basically, at least at FAST, and the bottom poorest percent is for the richest 20%. Since 1979, the bottom fifth of households have seen an increase on average of $200 over the entire 26-year period. In contrast, a small number of households at the top 0.1% of the income scale saw an average income growth of almost $6 million over the same time. These are figures from the Economic Policy Institute. What this translates into in terms of the position of corporations and healthcare corporations in terms of healthcare reform, healthcare corporations generally have, although they spend so much more on health insurance in the U.S. than they do internationally, they are reluctant to support single-payer systems, for example, that are publicly financed. They prefer to keep it private and partly to discipline the workforce. They oppose the government role, and they sell this opposition on the basis that it preserves our liberty and freedom of choice. The healthcare industry, of course, is a more particular case. They like holding on to their $2.5 trillion, basically, in short. The messages are sold to us through the corporate media. We hear consistently about what's bad about the bill, what's bad about single payer, what's bad about the government. The trend towards corporate ownership of the media has exacerbated the difficulty in our getting our messages through. Until the economy crashed in 2008, healthcare was considered the number one drag on the economy. Speculative bubbles burst. Again, I think we're pretty familiar, the housing bubble and the finance bubble. Our trade imbalances increased. We have wars that we can't pay for and continuing tax breaks for the wealthy, which has led to the redistribution of income that I mentioned and our inability to pay for social programs or for our wars or for our health care or for pretty much anything else. This is just showing the change in unemployment by race over the last couple of years, the crash in the housing bubble. So I guess what I want to say is that in addition to thinking about the healthcare system we would most like to see, and I think there's not a lot of disagreement about that, is the question of how we get our message through and how we talk about why we want a greater government role in paying for and providing health care, and getting clear on what the arguments are that are coming at us, and that they are tied up in the arguments we hear about our economy. The argument that it's the government's role basically to funnel contracts to corporations, minimize taxes, and slash regulation and social spending, versus creating wealth through productivity. Arguments that we might try to advocate for with the current administration, and I'll come back to that in a minute. The Republican agenda, the folks who are now in charge of the House since the last election, is to fight about health care as the lead up to 2012. They have said that they're going to focus on abortion as one of their key issues, and we'll hear more about that. Moderate Democrats and Republicans are working on a deficit commission, which may be issuing a report that will slash Medicare and Social Security, and are advocating for free trade and expanding exports as a solution to our economic problems. Some good news is that Democrats, to the extent that we'll see what they do, beat big money in Vermont and California. Vermont did elect a governor who is explicitly pro-single payer and says that that's high on his agenda and he wants to discuss it with the president. So what do we do? I think we have to get mobilized and stay mobilized. Corporate domination of campaign spending was successful in many races, but not all of them. Analyze what's working and do more of it. There's a shift in the power, number, and reach of traditional advocacy groups. We can do something about that. We can take the initiative also to create vehicles for advocacy. I suggest that we can educate people about what really is in the law, defend it, implement it, and improve it. On the issue of reproductive rights, that's something, again, we've got to speak about regularly and vigorously. 30% of women have had an abortion. We can no longer talk about safe, rare, and legal. Legal is the important part, and it's not rare, and it's not going to be rare. We have to talk about overturning the Hyde Amendment that well, I'm not going to get into all of Cindy's discussion. Again, we've mentioned the fact that we need to address the injustice to immigrants in the bill, and certainly at the same time can talk about support for state and national single-payer campaigns, reclaiming the important role of effective, accountable government in creating affordable health care, economic prosperity, and a socially just society. I think we can link healthcare advocacy with an agenda for economic and social justice, demand policies that create a healthy economy, call for public investment to re-stimulate productivity and demand, not just by cutting taxes, but by recognizing that jobs to lower income people does create demand, and that we need investment in healthcare, education, energy, and the environment, and that that is a program for economic growth, not just handouts. Need to talk about fair financing, tax breaks to wealthy individuals do not create jobs, and reaffirm the government role to support baseline survival, yes, and also to advance social justice and well-being, to guarantee the rule of law, and to take steps to empower organizations of civil society who will see that they do their job. This is where you can sign up for our listserv. I suggest it's not what we settle for. It's what we build, and we look forward to working together with folks at this table and in this room to build something that is progressive and will address the needs that we know lie ahead. So thank you.